The mules are in the corral. Welcome to Mule Talk, and I'm Cindy K. Roberts, your host.
On this episode of Mule Talk, we have back our author, TV personality, and world-renowned mule trainer, Meredith Hodges of the Lucky Three Ranch. Welcome back.
Glad to be back, especially on my birthday.
Of course. You know, I do kind of feel bad that you're having to work on your birthday, but this is such fun stuff. I know you're not being tortured too badly, are you?
Absolutely not. Anything to do with mules is not work. It's not torture. And it's everything I do on my birthday anyway. My mules are number one.
There you go. So every day is a birthday to us. Every day is mule day. Okay.
That's right. Every day is a mule day. Every day is my birthday. And every day is Mule Appreciation Day.
I like that. That's a good perspective to have. And today we're going to talk about the mule shows and showing in general. I had recently saw some kind of media post that the 4-H clubs are now honoring having mules in their shows.
That's been going on for quite some time now. In fact, that was one of the reasons I wrote my book, A Guide for Raising and Showing Mules, was because there was no horse manual, that really was pertinent to mules. Mules are quite different. So the rules in the 4-H club that pertain to horses didn't really fit the mules. But way back then, I think that was like in 2005, maybe, or 2006, mm-hmm. I had been promoting them because a lot of the kids wanted to work with mules. And now they even let the donkeys in there. And, you know, it started out a long time ago, in 1982, when we could not find mule shows anywhere to go to. So whatever we did, we just got together, those of us in a certain area. And then they did this in other areas. We just get together and do what we call fun shows. And one of the funnest things I do remember from back then was the game Monkey in a Tree, where you had to ride your mule up and your partner was hanging from a rope and you had to pick him up and then run back across the finish line.
Right.
That was great. We dreamed up all kinds of games to play back then with our mules. And so it was really fun, and it was really kind of funny about the way people thought about showing back then, too. First of all, they thought mules were awful. You know, they were stubborn and all those old things. So anybody with any kind of status did not ride one. Of course, those of us without status went right ahead and rode them anyway.
You bet.
And then other people were saying, oh, well, I don't have to train my mule because I'm only going to be doing trail riding. Well, I can tell you, if you want to be safe, you better train your animal no matter who they are.
Right.
You know, horse, mm-hmm. pony, donkey, mule, it doesn't matter. It's a safety factor. So you got to keep that in mind. So it's not just for people that show. And as we grew through the show, up to the showing stage where we got serious about it, I was writing rule books and everything with a national organization, the American Donkey and Mule Society. The American Mule Association in California wrote their own rule books. That was another thing that was pretty common about mule people. It was like, we'll write our own rules. And, you know, nobody really cared.
Okay.
We did need a set of rules nationally because not everybody had the wherewithal to write the rule books. So it didn't matter if two entities were writing rule books. And the American Mule Association was writing the rules so that Bishop Mule Days would have rules. Because when I went there in 1979, that show is packed with 60,000 people now, but you could pick your place in the grandstands back then. You know, it was just a small Bishop town show back then. There just wasn't a whole lot happening in training. But one of the biggest complaints that most of us mule people had was that we were being snubbed by the horse shows. And we were not allowed to show with the horses, so whenever we went to be in a show, we got turned away.
How dare them?
Well, but no. Our argument, I think, as I pointed out in the last podcast, that was that our mules are half horse, and your rules say horses can show, and so we should be able to. But
sure,
they didn't take kindly to that. It was their show; they organized it, and I understood that. Not only that, the American Horse Show Association back then was adamant about not letting mules in because they were picking riders for the Olympic competitions. And so these riders that were showing in the horse shows were accumulating points. And our mules, they're so good at everything they do, they would have offset the points because they would have won shows over the horses. So we may not have gotten our best riders into the Olympics if that happened. So I just kind of changed my approach and I said, well, you know, you're the professionals, you've been doing this longer than we have, we need some guidance with our mules, and the only way we're going to be able to progress to the level of horsemanship that you guys have progressed to is to learn from you. So we would really appreciate it if you would allow us to come to your shows. And I even told them to, I would wait in the parking lot for my turn because they were saying that my mules would scare the horses. And I went, okay, I get that. And then they even said, well, you know, it's really not a fair competition. And I said, look, if you don't want to give me a ribbon, then that's fine too. Just tell me where I placed and don't give me a ribbon. And if I'm first or second, give it to the next horse in line or whatever. I really don't care. I am not here to win a show or win a ribbon or anything like that. And that was one of the things that was really different about our mule shows. When we put our mule shows together, we exemplified good sportsmanship. Mule people were not in it for the money. They weren't in it for the prizes. They were in it to have a rendezvous with their friends and have a lot of fun with their mules. And that's why we put our shows together. And that's why our shows even today are so much different than horse shows. Because a lot of times, now they do have some classes that are monetized. But back then, you know, if you got a prize in a mule show, once they started coming together and we had shows, they were given useful prizes for their placements. You know, if you got a first place, for instance, you got a stable blanket. If you got second place, you got a halter. If you got third, you got lead ropes, you know, and things like that that would be very useful.
Okay.
And a lot of people in our industry didn't have a whole lot of money either. So
right,
our entry fees were really low. And that was just so we could promote our shows and draw people in and allow everybody to participate. And when we were writing the rule books, we said, silver saddles will not make a difference. A nice, neat appearance will be required, but not a fancy, fancy show outfit. So that anybody could come, and if they had a clean shirt on and a pair of jeans, they were fine. So I think having that good sportsmanship attitude really resonated across all the mule shows that we started building. And this is what makes us so unique in everything that we do, is because it's our camaraderie. When somebody forgot to bring a bridle or didn't have the right saddle or something and we had an extra one, we made sure they could make their class by loaning them the equipment that they needed.
Oh,
anything.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Because like I said, you know, it's all the camaraderie of the people. I mean, we're all just low man on the totem pole anyway because we ride a mule. According to society, the equestrian society, although, in all fairness, I must say that a lot of people in the equestrian industry have had their eyes opened because of the things that the people in our industry have been able to do. We over the years, we have come up in the world, and thanks to the people who allowed us to participate in their shows and test our abilities. You know, I, for instance, rode with a lot of different trainers and had clinics with a lot of different trainers. And in the beginning, when I was doing Gymkhana and Western events and such, I had a clinic with Ray Hunt, Buck Brannaman, John Lyons. I had been out to Monty Roberts Ranch, and that was an interesting experience because Richard Schrake was, I had done three clinics at my ranch with Richard Schrake. I let him use my ranch, and then I participated in the clinic with him as an instructor. But he was out at Monty Roberts Ranch in Solvang one time, and he called me up, and he goes, "Oh, Meredith, we need you out there right away." Are you kidding me? That's in California. I'm in Colorado. This is not going to work very well. He goes, Oh no, we really need you. I said, "Okay, Richard, what's the story?" And he said, "Well, we started lunging this horse Boomer in the round pen, and we can't catch him now." I said, "Are you kidding me?" This was in the morning. And I said, "Okay, I will hop a plane, and I will be there as soon as I can get there." And when I got there, Boomer was still in the round pen. Nobody was bothering him. He was just kind of standing in there. But I brought my fanny pack full of oats with me, and I walked into the round pen. And I must say, this is what changed my mind about having... I always kind of thought that the round pen should not be enclosed, and a lot of people back then were thinking that solid sides were the way to go, and that's the way this round pen was. The theory was that you could get the animal's attention better if he wasn't distracted by things on the outside. I kind of thought, no, that doesn't seem to make sense to me, because if you train him in a round pen and he never sees anything, then when you get outside, he's going to see everything, and he's going to spook at everything. But if you have him in a round pen that is open and has a lot going on, he will learn to look to you for support and for comfort. And that's the way I kind of thought of it, and as it turned out, that worked out really well. So anyway, I got there, and I walked in the door into the solid round pen. Everybody else was standing on a platform around the upper deck, which itself has got to be disconcerting for the animal to have all these people looking down on them. But I walked in there, and Boomer looked at me and started bolting around the side of the round pen, and I just said, no, Boomer, I came a long way to see you. And he kind of slowed down because I didn't approach him. I just stood in the middle. And I said, "But I brought a present for you." And he looked at me. He stopped and he looked at me. And I opened up the zipper of my fanny pack. And I started just twiddling the oats back into the fanny pack. And his ears perked up. And he goes, "Ooh, what's that?" And I said, "Boomer, this is for you." And I started walking towards him, and his eyes were fixated on those oats. And then he'd look at me, and then he'd look at the oats. I said, "You don't have to bolt. You don't have to run. Everything is fine." You know, and I just kept talking to him. Now, another thing back then, too, was that you aren't supposed to talk to him, and you aren't supposed to look him in the eye.
Yeah, well, I did right.
I did both. You know, they tell you, if you're a human being and you're being polite, when you talk to somebody, you're supposed to look them in the eye. That's polite. Mm. And that's what I learned. And so that's what I went ahead and did with all my animals, too. I looked them in the eye, and I talked to them politely. And I used their name. And I asked them how they were, you know, all of those.
Sure, why not?
All those polite things. And pretty soon I'm just standing there right next to Boomer, and I'm giving him the oats, and he's cocking his head towards me and saying how much he would like some more. And I said, "Well, that's fine. I'll give you some more." And I didn't grab the bridle or anything like that. I didn't grab the reins. I just stood there and talked to him until he sighed. And, you know, the other thing they told you back then was you'll know that they're comfortable when they're licking and chewing. Well, I thought the fastest way to make them lick and chew is give them a handful of oats. They gotta chew to eat
yeah,
them.
Right, yeah.
You know? So that's the fastest way to that. So that's why I just went ahead and did that. And Boomer was buying that hook, line, and sinker. And when he finally sighed and he was comfortable and relaxed and everything, then I just took the rein of the bridle off the saddle horn and put the reins off of the saddle horn. And I went ahead and led him to the door. And I said, okay, where do you want him? And everybody was like, ooh, and they all clapped and everything. And I went 1,000 miles to catch a horse.
That's something to be said. So, wow.
Yeah. And I learned a lot from that experience, and so did Richard. Richard told me that, yeah, that was a very sensible approach, and how he thought those enclosed round pens were, you know, a good way to go too. But then he saw that it was much better, because even when I led Boomer out, he did not spook at all the people that were around him, all the activities that were going on, and everything was cool.
Yeah,
you know?
Wow.
And then another Western trainer that I studied with and I had firsthand experience with, I decided that I could not train a reining mule, but I wanted Sundowner to go ahead and do well and at Bishop Mule Days. And I thought one of the things that he might be able to do at 3 years old was reining. And Steve Schwarzenberger was training right down around the corner from me. So I went ahead and took him down to Steve and asked him to train him down there. And then I went down there regularly to watch them and to learn from Steve how to do all of this, because I was planning on riding him. And as it turned out, I thought that it would be better to keep the same rider on him for Bishop Mule Day's competition the next year in 1984. And so Steve rode him, and they won the reining out at Bishop, and it was great.
Wow.
But I soon found out that Steve was an exceptional rider, but I wasn't. So when I got on Sundowner after the World Championship, I could not necessarily make him go the way that Steve did.
Okay.
You know, because I had to learn to ride the reining moves in a balanced way. Then
yeah, okay.
Sundowner began to do the right things when I got my own body balanced. And that's why I say that it's so important to not only get their bodies going right, but, you know, by developing their core strength and their balance, but that also, when they're right, gives you the opportunity to start working on yourself without worrying about how they're doing, because they can hold their own gates and everything in balance once it becomes their habitual way of going. The other thing that I did was, at that time, the American Quarter Horse Association was putting out books on various disciplines. And one of the books that I got, and one of the clinics I went to, was with Al Dunning in reining. And he just made reining look so easy.
Didn't he, though?
Oh, my God. The guy is a professional all the way to the core. He was such a pleasure to watch and to learn from. You know, I learned a lot that helped me to ride my reining mule. And then I went out to Bishop, and I thought that they should go ahead and start cattle classes, not just reining, the cattle classes. And Pat Pirelli had bought a mule from my mom, and I went to several of his clinics, and he used to ride Sissy Bridleless out there at Bishop and do reining on her. And so we thought, yeah, this is legit, and Bishop went ahead and took on the cattle classes and everything. I also took clinics from Quentin Anderson, too, but I don't think he wanted to risk his reputation with a mule.
Oh,
he was, you know, he had a lot of good ideas and everything, but still, I thought, he kind of made me think that I really had to pay attention to the engagement of the hindquarters, because his biggest thing was disengaging the hindquarters and making the animal be submissive.
Okay.
And I noticed that his horses were pretty much on the forehand, and I think they could have done a lot better had they not disengaged their hindquarters. Mm. But, you know, in going through with these Western trainers like that, I learned a lot of things from them. And I, you know, a lot of it was really good, but a lot of it was kind of not good. You know, like those early ones, John Lyons, for instance, he thought that roping the front leg was okay and letting them, you know, making them stop with the rope around the front leg. And I thought, well, you know, although he's kind of gentle about it, I don't think there's any reason to put a rope on him, much less even rope him around the neck. That's not what you're going to be doing.
Right, yeah.
And I think it's just, it falls in the same category as a lot of things. I try to put myself in the animal's position and think, now what must they be thinking about what we're doing? And like we talked about in desensitization, I don't think they think that we're very logical when we do things like chasing them, putting ropes around their neck that fly over their head, and chasing them around the round pen and everything. Doesn't really promote a relationship or an intimate relationship. What it does, I think, is it promotes submissiveness.
Mm, right.
And when you do that, slaves soon become resentful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just my feeling. Now, you know, these guys have done some pretty remarkable things in their careers. So you got to give them, you know, credit for that. You know, and they have opened the eyes of a lot of people, and they have been very good in the beginning when I was first training. They warned me against publishing all these secrets that I used for training, and they told me that if you give away your secrets, that nobody's going to pay you for anything. And I thought, well, you know, there's millions of people in the world, and some may want to do it themselves and may not hire a trainer after they learn. But most of them will still need a trainer as a coach, you know, even if they try these things. It doesn't necessarily going to, you know, mean it's going to work for them. So they still need trainers, and they're, it, you just kind of got to reassess what your value is, you know, to other people. And there's plenty of other people out there to go ahead and become your coach, your trainer, and there's still a market for it. So I don't think they're going to lose income that way anyway, and that's why I started giving away the things that I knew. And the first thing was when I was using draw reins. They said, oh, don't put the draw reins in the hands of a beginner. And I said, well, how else are they going to learn?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
How else are they going to learn? Oh, we'll train the horse, and then they won't have to, you know, fight with it at all. I said, well, with draw reins, you're not supposed to be fighting. You're just supposed to get your hands steady enough to use them. You know, you don't use them if you got bad hands, you know, so you do need a coach to teach you how to ride so you won't, you know, abuse the animal's mouth or anything by putting something on them. But when I talked to Richard, we both, Richard Schreck, we both agreed that the draw rein effect was good because it would cause the animal to round their frame, but that we need to figure out how we could do it where it wasn't in the hands of the rider. And that's what the elbow pull is all about. It's completely controlled by the animal itself. All you have to do is adjust it properly. And you adjust it so they can't flip their head up so high that they invert their neck and their back. The rest of the range of motion is totally free. They can put their head up above the withers. They can put it down to the ground. They can put it to both sides freely without being hampered in any way, shape, or form. And then, once they got them in good posture, then they had to address their balance, their cadence, their rhythm, their way of going. And the first thing I wanted to learn about was their feet and make sure that they were being trimmed properly, because mules and donkeys have steeper angles, so they need more heel, they're more upright. And I looked into, what is a farrier supposed to do? And I found two books that were really exceptional. One of them was done by Dr. Doug Butler and Jacob Butler, called The Principles of Horseshoeing.
Oh, that's a good book. That's an excellent book.
Everybody's library. Yes. Yeah, it's outstanding. And then when we were having so much trouble finding anybody that knew about donkeys and mules, I discovered Pete Ramsey. And he wrote The Care and Rehabilitation of the Equine Foot. And he knows donkeys and mules inside out. And I bought his video series, too, and his books. And so that gave me the information about the feet. And then I took some exceptional dressage clinics. I read a lot of books to start out with, but as I've said before, they kind of threw me for a loop in the beginning. But I thought, well, maybe they'll make sense to me after I start taking lessons. But I read Al Lapidoski's book, from the Spanish Riding School of Vienna, all about dressage. Charles de Comfy, Gerd Hushman on classical dressage, and Reiner Klimke. And then I audited a clinic with Hilda Gurney and Robert Dover, our Olympians, and Dolly Hannon, who was fairly close to me. And then the one that really thrilled me the best was when I hired Melinda Weatherford to be my personal instructor in dressage and combined training, and I was with her for 10 years, and I got to have clinics with some of the very best, among which was Major Anders Lindgren from the Swedish Olympic team, Jim Graham from the U.S. Olympic team, Bruce Davidson from the U.S. Olympic team, and Danny Emerson. I had three clinics with him from our U.S. Olympic team, and all of them were rather shocked when Lindy said that, I've got a client here that wants to bring her mule to the clinic. They kind of looked at her sideways, like, are you serious? But we did so well. When they asked us to do something, we could do it. And they showed me how to approach it so that I could do it. And I was such a good listener and such a good learner that I think they appreciated my attitude, too. I knew I was low man on the totem pole, and I was just honored that they would even let me ride with the horses. I felt very privileged that they even let me in the clinic, much less be my teacher. And I learned so much from those people, and I brought it to the mule world, and I tested my mules in absolutely everything that I could while I was doing this. And one of the most impressionable clinics that I had was right here in Colorado. I was of the mind that once you got old, you couldn't really be an equine instructor anymore, because you hadn't been riding for a while. Therefore, how could you know anything? A young person will think like that, we're young, we know what's going on, and we're agile and we can ride. But once you're too old to really ride, you're pretty worthless as an instructor. But boy, I had somebody turn my head around about that, showed me just how arrogant I was being. And that was 83-year-old Sally Swift.
Oh, yes.
The author of Centered Riding.
Yeah.
Sally, I think I learned more from her in the beginning than I had collectively from all those Western trainers and everything, because I was having trouble by this time. I was showing. By this time, the mule shows were cropping up all over. The horses were letting us compete in the open shows, which was really interesting, because I petitioned those And so they would have breed shows, you know, where they would have a show with their breeds and specifically to the breeds, Morgans, Saddlebreds, and occasionally they would combine the Morgans and the Saddlebreds because they both had high action and they were shown in driving, and they had, then they had the Saddlebreds and the Tennessee Walkers and Buckstriders had all these exceptional gaits and everything. And so, but they did have an open class. And so we went to those kinds of shows, and we would show in their open classes. And Lucky Three CG, I used to use for side saddle. And I got into one of those pleasure classes, the side saddle pleasure class, against the Tennessee Walkers, the Fox Trotters, the Saddlebreds, and everything. And first time I took second place. The next year I got back, I went into the class when it was called, and I was the only one there.
And I said, okay,
well, what happened? Where's everybody else? And they said they heard you were going to be in the class, and they all dropped out. I just went, well, they must have known I was going to win, you know. And then I had maybe CT in the English pleasure class at that show, that same show, and that was an open class. And I showed against those horses, and there was about 15 in the class, and B placed third against all those high-action horses.
Wow, that's amazing.
Well, I thought it was. I didn't think they'd give me anything, to tell you the truth, you know. They did, and that was just so cool. And then, of course, I competed maybe CT in the combined training in the first year, over dressage stadium jumping and cross country. Everybody laughed at me and made snide remarks about us. And we placed eighth out of about 15 riders, and that was really good. And then the second year in, I think it was 92, we placed second. And Susan Farmer, who owned the Abbey Ranch Horse Farm, and she put on the Abbey Ranch Horse Trials, she personally came up to me and presented us with our second place ribbon. And I remember what she said. She said, "We're not prejudiced here. Congratulations." So I think it's more important to participate and learn.
Yeah.
It makes for attainable long-term goals, and even more, it makes for long-term friendships. And Susan came up to me the next year when I took first place, and she was just tickled to death that I had made that kind of progress in 3 years. And they adopted me, and maybe CT is their official mascot for the Northern Colorado Dressage Association.
Well, that's pretty cool.
It really was, but it was all about attitude, and it was all about, you know, taking the things that you could learn from all of these different trainers. You know, everybody has something to offer, so it bodes well when you're quiet enough and ask enough questions to listen and to learn, you know, and when you do that, you will learn. And things will go better. Now, the one thing that I did discover early was how willing the American Driving Society was to allow mules to be in their driving shows. They wouldn't let us in the specific breed classes, but again, they would let us in the open classes.
Yeah.
And I found that we did very, very well in those classes. We placed high. And none of those horses in driving ever spooked from the mule at all. The other thing that was another class that we got into that I thought was exceptional was in endurance and competitive trail riding. Now, there was a gal, C. Wolf, here in Colorado that competed her mules until she was 80 years old.
Really?
And she did a remarkable job of setting the stage for mules being accepted in competitive trail and endurance riding in the American Horse Show Association. And they were, you know, very, very willing to let them in and praise them because of her work. And so she did some exceptional promotion work for mules. And so we got into the driving and the endurance early, but it took us another 18 years from when Seawolf got them in the competitive trail. And since the time they were allowed in endurance, 18 more years before we got into dressage and combined training. And then it was really cool because when that happened, we progressed, and I, along with the help of a lot of other people, spent that 18 years proving how good mules could be in dressage. And that came to fruition in 2014 when Laura Hermanson showed Hartley Dinah in the dressage finals in Kentucky. And she did very well out there. I think they might have placed eighth or something, but those were top horses.
Competing
officially in the points accumulation United States Equestrian Federation. And it took us, like I said, 18 years to get there. So that was pretty remarkable. But in doing all this stuff, we learned how good our mules could really be if we improved our own equestrian skills and took everything seriously that way. But with a mule, as you well know, don't take yourself too seriously because you will be humbled.
So, in a matter of time, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, like that same day.
Yeah.
In that same moment, and it doesn't matter where it is. I remember when my husband and I were showing up in Winnemucca, Nevada, and I had this Arabian mule, Bucky 3 Cyclone, who was he was one of the mules that did a capriole when he was out there playing. But I had four other mules in training, so I let him ride him. And he was the comic relief in every show. My husband refused to learn. He would take lessons, and my instructor said, well, maybe he just doesn't like taking lessons from you because he's married to you. And I thought, that's a really good point, Lindy, so I'll let you give him the lessons. And so she gave him the lessons, and 3 months later she came to me and she says, no, it's not you. It's him. You can tell him everything, and he just doesn't seem to want to listen. He and Cyclone are doing their own thing. And so every show that we went to, he would enter Western Pleasure, and they would do very well at the walk and very well at the trot. And then when they asked for a canter, Cyclone would run away. So he would be going at top speed around and around the arena, passing everybody, and the crowd roared. That was so funny. So like I said, they were comic relief. But the one time when we were in Winnemucca, we were just going to the arena, and we had a parade in front of the grandstands. And we were going to do a little race first, just a straight quarter-mile race. The flag went down. We started galloping. This should have been right up Cyclone's alley. I thought, how bad can he be?
Right.
He runs every time in the pleasure class.
There you go.
So they took off, and we all took off down the stretch of the grand, got in front of the grandstands. Everybody runs right on through. Except Cyclone. It had rained the night before. Cyclone stopped, dead raining stop, sliding stop, ducked his head, and dumped my husband face first in a puddle.
Ooh.
Right in front of the grandstand.
Oh, well, wow.
Oh, the mud was soft. Nobody got hurt, but Gary was humiliated.
And another lesson learned.
Another lesson learned. On the other side of that, I have seen some truly, truly inspirational riders in my life. One of them that really just grabbed me in dressage, and I swore I would get my mules to be as light and as free-flowing as this trainer did in the 1992, maybe. Nicole Uphoff, a German Grand Prix rider that rode Rembrandt. They looked like they were floating on air. And she is one of Germany's most successful Olympians in dressage. She won 4 gold medals at the 1998, 1992 on her legendary horse Rembrandt. She added a 3rd Olympics to her tally in 96 and collected gold at 4 European championships in 89, 91, 93, and 95, and 2 World Equestrian Games in 1990 and 94. She made a comeback in 98 with Gestut Vorwachs Rubenstein and retired from the international competition sport in the 2000s.
Wow.
She was remarkable.
Oh, yeah.
And she was my role model. She was what I wanted my mules to do. I have never seen an animal look like they were floating over the ground and truly doing of their own accord like Rembrandt did. It was just, it dumbstruck me. It took my breath away. And there were a couple other places that I saw some incredible horsemanship in addition to the white stallions from the Spanish riding school. There's a traveling show called Cavalia, and they do a lot of bridleless stuff with their horses. They use primarily liposomers and Andalusians in their show. They have a few other breeds in there too, but their horsemanship is just incredible. So if you have a chance to see them, I would definitely take that opportunity.
Yeah, they're exceptional. I did have the opportunity to go see them when they came to St. Louis.
They're awesome, aren't they?
Yeah, it just takes your breath away.
Yeah, it really does. And you know, that's modern day. You know, that's today that these things are happening. And the other one that inspired me to work with my mules in multiples, and I did have, what was it, 6 teams working, and I wanted to ride the back team. I was too old to do Roman riding, and I knew I would kill myself if I tried.
Good idea.
I settled with riding one and having one next to me and having 5 teams out in front, but I had to get them all there before I could actually do the 6 teams all at the same time. But I did get to riding one team and having 3 teams out in front of me, and that was coming along really good, but my animals were getting pretty old, and I lost my front team, which was my solid team. And I thought, well, I'm not going to make it now, but I got far enough to suit me, and this is really good. But the person that really inspired me to even try that was Lorenzo the Flying Frenchman.
Oh, and yes.
Andalusians. Oh, my God, another thing that just took my breath away. And he Roman rode those.
Oh,
you know?
Wow, yeah.
And he did them freely. He did not even have lines on them when he was doing his shows.
Oh,
no bridles, no lines. I mean, they got so good. You know, and I thought, oh, I wish I was young enough to Roman ride, because then I would do it. But I can settle for this riding one on the back team and getting the others out in front. Because, number one, I'm riding mules, not horses. Horses tend to stay in their herd.
Right.
Mules, you have all alpha personalities. I'm going this way, I'm going that way. And one of the things that reminded me that I was not in control when I was training this all in the round pen before we got to the outdoor arena, which we did. You know, we did eventually make it there, but I was training one team, and I got 3 teams done, and then I thought, okay, who am I going to add here? And I had 2 alpha males. I had Mr. Moon, and I called him Mooney Tunes, and there's a reason for that. And I had Sir Lancelot, who was definitely Lance romance. I'm going to impress everyone on my own.
Oh, sure.
You know, so I put those two together. And I was trying to teach them to ground drive together. And, of course, they were nitpicking each other to start with, you know, just taking little nips at each other while they're standing still. And then I told them, I said, you guys, cut that out. And they both looked at me, and they went, oh, the mama's mad. Don't make the mama mad. You know how things go when we make the mama mad. And so I said, oh, good, guys, you're going to be really good. Okay, walk on. And I'm standing behind them with the drive lines, and they walked about 5 feet, 5 steps forward. And then they both swung their hips out to where now they were still side by side, but now they were walking towards me.
Oh.
And they both came towards me at a nice slow walk and stopped in front of the fanny pack and said, didn't we do good? I went, what the heck is this? I will unzip the fanny pack and you'll find out. So I unzipped the fanny pack and they both dove in and they go, we got our reward for being good. These guys are not going to work as lead animals. Not at all. They're going to turn around and bring the whole, all the teams backwards.
Right, right.
So I decided that wasn't such a hot idea with those two.
Well, Meredith, you've been awesome as always, and I want to thank you for sharing your expertise on the mule shows. Now we're finally getting some respect.
Well, and it's not just about respect, Cindy. It's about we were willing to do the work to make our mules noticeable, and we were being polite and considerate in the equine industry, which elicited the same thing back from them. And now we have more people in the horse industry that are really curious about mules and getting them as second animals.
Yeah, well said. Very well said. You have a website.
I do, at www.lucky3ranch, three is all spelled out, not the number three, .com. And I also have a Facebook page at Meredith Hodges Public Figure. I have a friends page, but it's maxed out. But just so you know, I put the same thing on both pages so nobody gets left out. And if you have any questions or concerns, you're always welcome to write to me at Meredith@Lucky3Ranch.com, and I will answer you promptly. And for the kids and adult kid-minded adults, we have JasperTheMule.com. Because you know we're all young at heart.
Yes. And what about your phone number?
My phone number is 1-800-816-7566.
Now you get to go eat birthday pie.
Well, yeah, they're mini pies. Our caterer makes these little mini pies that are really good. He makes lemon ones. He makes chocolate cheesecake ones.
Ooh.
Yeah, he makes all chocolate ones. He's very creative.
Okay, well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
All right, Meredith, thank you so much. Of course, we'll talk soon.
You betcha.
If you'd like to be a guest on the show or a sponsor, send me an email.
Everycowgirlsdream@gmail.com.
Gotta go. My mule is looking for me.
Mule Talk is an Every Cowgirl's Dream production.